Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the growing threat of cybercrime. We'll learn more about a local cyber boot camp designed to teach individuals how to protect their identities, financial assets, and online presence. It's at the Rosendale Theater, January 22nd, and you can learn how to take control of your cybersecurity and protect yourself from the constant barrage of digital threats. The next steps for the Livingston Manor Roscoe Schools merger. Applications are open for the new school board, and the election is less than a month away. Jason Dole reports. Plus, author Busy Coy's new humor book, Personal Space, and a special reading this weekend celebrating art and literature. And Ariel Zevon, the daughter of renowned musician Warren Zevon, returns to the colony in Woodstock with Danielle Miraglia. We'll speak to both musicians. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Several of President-elect Trump's nominees for his cabinet are having Senate confirmation hearings today. That includes for U.S. Attorney General nominee Pam Bondi. Judiciary Committee Chair Senator Chuck Grassley says Bondi, a former Florida Attorney General, is prepared for the job.
And performance as Attorney General, prosecutor, and community leader speaks volumes about her character and her dedication to the rule of law.
Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin says President-elect Trump has vowed to use the Justice Department to punish his enemies.
He has repeatedly threatened to arrest, prosecute, jail, and otherwise punish those he considers his enemies. This includes reporters, prosecutors, judges, poll workers, military officials, and even his own former political appointees.
Bondi has personally represented Trump during his first impeachment trial in the Senate. She has also advanced false claims of voting fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Negotiators in Qatar are trying to iron out last-minute wrinkles preventing an agreement on a multi-phase ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. The deal aims to end the 15-month-old war in Gaza. As NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, U.S. and Israeli officials say they're waiting on a response from Hamas.
Both the current and incoming U.S. administrations have people in Doha helping to mediate the deal. A representative of Hamas here in the Middle East tells NPR there is agreement on the broader issues. But Hamas says it's waiting on more detailed maps of the proposed withdrawal of Israeli troops from areas in Gaza, which Israel denies. The source spoke on the condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of the talks. The final deal is expected to begin with a six-week ceasefire in Gaza and allow for the exchange of dozens of Israeli hostages for hundreds of Palestinian detainees. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Weather forecasters say very dangerous winds may pick up soon around Los Angeles. The winds fueled the destructive firestorm in LA that broke out last week. NPR's Katie Riddle reports on how the disaster is affecting people.
In the last week, hundreds of people have come to emergency evacuation centers to receive help, including mental health support. Melissa Breimer is director of the Terrorism and Disaster Program at UCLA. She says providers here are practicing a kind of therapy called psychological first aid, helping people meet physical needs in service of mental health needs.
So part of what we do is help people not to look at the long term, but what is that next step?
Breimer says food, water, medicine, reuniting with loved ones, that's all people have room to think about right now. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Los Angeles.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 1.5%. The NASDAQ is up nearly 2%. You're listening to NPR. The Labor Department says consumer prices rose 2.9% last month from what they were a year ago. Prices rose for gas, food, and rent. The inflation report has triggered that surge on Wall Street. This week's Billboard charts are out with two new albums battling it out for number one. NPR Stephen Thompson has more.
Two superstars put out new records in the opening days of 2025. Now they hold the top spots on the Billboard albums chart. The first is the rapper Lil Baby, whose new album Wham, that stands for Who Hard Is Me, dropped January 3rd. Then there's Debí Tirar Más Fotos, the new album from Bad Bunny. It dropped on January 5th, 2 days after Lil Baby. In the end, Lil Baby had the top seller, Bad Bunny had the top streamer, and the upper hand went to Lil Baby. Bad Bunny had to settle for second place, at least for now. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Civil rights activist Jose Chacha Jimenez died on January 10th at the age of 76, according to his sister. No cause of death was announced. In the late 60s, Jimenez transformed the Young Lords street gang in Chicago into a social movement for civil rights and fair housing, especially for the Puerto Rican community. Jimenez later co-founded the Rainbow Coalition, along with Black Panther Party chair Fred Hampton. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As the world grapples with an ever-increasing wave of cyber attacks, identity theft, and data breaches, experts are sounding the alarm. It's no longer just companies or governments that need to worry about protecting their data. Individuals must also take responsibility. With the threat landscape constantly evolving, the need for personal cyber defense has never been more urgent. Enter Rivka Tadger and Roberto Garodello, two prominent figures in the fight against cybercrime. They're offering a unique solution to help individuals safeguard their personal data and protect their identities in the digital age. It's a workshop as part of the Rosendale Theater's Today I Learned talk series on January 22nd. And here with the preview is Rivka Tadger. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for
having me on.
Well, thank you for being here. And I want to get into, you know, some of the things that people need to look out for and how they can protect themselves. But I want to talk to you first about your impressive background as a business and tech journalist with extensive experience in privacy and security. You were also at a time with the White House National Infrastructure Advisory Council. How did you come to focus on cybercrime prevention and mitigation?
Well, so starting as a journalist and a writer in my DNA, you know, if I had been alive at the turn of the last century, I would be covering the Industrial Revolution, right? So I immediately zeroed in on privacy, security, identity theft, AI, data mining, because I cover the sociological implications of technology, how our behavior is changing.
Mm-hmm. And you focusing on the sociological impacts of technology, especially in relation to the dark web and TikTok culture and TikTok, of course, in the headlines now. How do you see these modern technologies shaping criminal behavior and identity theft in this digital age?
Well, so we focus purely on behavior, right? And it's important because all of the when you talked before about the big companies and the enterprises, it's always through a human being that you get access. And human beings have third-party risk now, from your doctor's office to your bank. And I specialize in financial protection. So people are too afraid of AI. They're too afraid of these things. It's not Big Brother. It's Little Brother, right? So you have to take care of Little Brother. You can play with Little Brother, but you also have to discipline Little Brother. So if we understand criminal behavior, we can prevent victim behavior. And it's really a matter of moving from everything is convenient, everything is convenient, to, okay, let's take pause. We've had these, you know, iPhones in our hands since 2008. We just ran for convenience. And now we have to take a little look. And but you can become impervious to these things, and it's all about behavior.
Well, and I want to ask you about some of these behaviors and habits that people can adopt to make themselves impervious with these threats associated with cybercrime. How can someone be more proactive in safeguarding their personal identifiable information, or I guess it's called shorthand, is it PII?
PII.
PII, okay.
So, and PII is everything. So, if you get money stolen, that's just the beginning. They're going to hit you again. All right, so quick tips. Applying principles everywhere in your life. AI can't apply principles or implement ideas. It just grabs what's out there. So we have to be a little less junkie-like about our use. So for example, log out of Facebook. Don't stay logged in 24/7. That's why everyone is cloned. That's where they grab your IP address. That's where they grab all this information, and they're off to the races, right? And if you happen to buy stuff on Facebook Marketplace, they get your stored card. Log off. Don't have your default be I'm on, right? And this is a simple thing. It's one of those, you know, you turn the ship 10 degrees, just to turn the wheel a little, and then when you go down the road, you're in a different direction.
Yeah.
Right? That's a big habitual change for us.
Well, and also I think that maybe just in when, you know, just in personal daily day-to-day use of these websites or apps, when you close the window or close the app, you think to yourself perhaps, "Oh, I'm logged off. I'm out." But it's still on.
Exactly. You have to sign off. And you have to learn about your phone, right? So, for example, Apple IDs are being stolen all the time. They change the email, they change your phone number. They hijack it, and if that happens, you're done. Apple can never get it back. They get that nice credit card you have stored on there for buying apps, and there are settings that can prevent this. Literally settings that you just don't allow the changes in your account. They're weirdly under screen time. This is one of the things that we do, is we show people how to use their phones, right? And where all the little settings are and all the little hidden things are, where you can turn off the fact that they're selling all of your data, right? Because the law is far behind. So a lot of it is taking a pause and learning about this tool that's in your hand. It doesn't control you. You're supposed to control it.
And you mentioned the social media apps and, you know, Apple ID, but you have a lot of work in fraud prevention, financial crime, which you mentioned. What are some common mistakes people make when it comes to securing their financial information specifically online?
They use that email they literally use for everything else, for their bank accounts. Yeah. All right. So go get yourself a nice, secure, encrypted email. One of my favorites is Proton Mail. You know, the Russian oligarchs use it to secure their Swiss bank accounts, and Interpol can't find them, right? So when your bank tells you, hey, you're logging onto the secure portal and emailing us, that protects the bank, okay? The minute the bank emails you at that Gmail you use for everything else, right, game over. You're not protected. You have to be very careful. The problem with PII is once it's breached, it's toothpaste out of the tube. It's never being put back in. You have to make sure that that persona that's out there, you have to find out what's out there and then never, ever, ever have it lead to your assets. You have to have a public life and a private life. And these kinds of things are going to tap back into a collective consciousness that we know. Right? You wouldn't put all your gold out there. I have my mother's gold watch, okay? And I still, you know, I ride the subway because in New York City, I take it off when I ride the subway. Take your watch off when you ride the subway.
You mentioned that you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So when data is breached, it can't truly be contained. Can you elaborate a bit on why that's the case and what individuals could do to protect themselves when their data is compromised, when that toothpaste is out of the tube?
Yep. The reason it is because it's already in the ether and it's been bought and sold and bought and sold and bought and sold. And data wholesalers, you know, like Experian, who they're not the cavalry to protect you. There are all kinds of places that they legally sell data, especially your financial data, pre-approved, you know, old credit scores. They sell from the dark web to the internet. You're never going to contain that. You can't. All right. So what you do is you know what's out there. Here's the entire methodology. You find out literally what's out there in an anonymous way, so hackers don't know you're looking. And then you scrub what you can. And then to protect your financial assets, you create an entirely new set of persona that is never, ever public. Okay, you do the same for all the healthcare and federal and state agencies you have to deal with. All right, you have to set up and silo your personas so that when they grab your social security number, they just can't do anything with it, because that's how you stop worrying. You have to think imperviousness, not that you're running 10 steps ahead with, you know, the guy in the hoodie chasing you, right? You have to take a deep breath and be proactive.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Rivka Tadyar, who is hosting a cybercrime defense workshop as part of the Today I Learned Talk series at the Rosendale Theater. life skills you need to know about how to prevent cybercrime from affecting you. It's Wednesday, January 22nd at 7. Rivka, you have been following this and for years, and given the rapid pace of technological innovation and just this evolving nature of cybercrime and identity theft, how do you see this cybersecurity landscape changing over the next, I don't know, 5-10 years, and should individuals or organizations be prepared for more?
Absolutely. We knew after 9/11 that the attacks that were coming are going to be cyber, and they're just going to continue to come. And here's the mantra, honestly, and the reason why I left organizations, like the White House and big enterprises to help individuals and smaller businesses, is you cannot, like any other relationship in your life, you cannot control other people's behavior. We cannot control how long it will take the law or your healthcare system. They're trying. COVID sped all of this up. You have to protect yourself. Okay. Of course, it's all going to run at the speed of light, but crime is crime. And it's metaphorically going to be, don't wear your gold watch on the subway. Don't walk in dense urban environments at 2 a.m. with your map out and your wallet dropping bills on the street, right? You have to understand what the cyber equivalent is of that and not do it, right? And we do know. It's just you have to start visualizing the cyber world in order to incorporate it. And I tell people, think of it like medical. The only other invisible part of your life is the inside of your body. You go to that annual physical and they take a blood test, right? And they find something they don't like. They're like, we better do a whole full panel and take a look. That's exactly what we do. We do a cyber test version, a blood test, see what the symptoms are, and then treat them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you have an acute illness, or you have disease, or something's wrong, what do? You change your diet, you take some medications, you do it, and you evolve with it. It's very similar. The important thing is not to act from a base of fear. You can have power over this thing. And unfortunately, part of the marketing of all the value of AI exacerbates this fear. And people get breach letters every week in your social security numbers in the dark web. All right. That doesn't mean that it's the end of the world. There are things you can do. And that's really what I want to tell people. There are things you can do. Come learn the behaviors. Because once you know the principles, you'll start applying them. And as things evolve, you'll apply them.
And I wanted to mention your company, Zero Hack, which you co-founded with Roberto Gottardello. Roberto spent almost 30 years serving in covert military operations for the United States Department of Defense, Department of State, and other agencies. You guys have an extensive background in this area. And one of the things I found interesting about your particular involvement in some organizations to protect vulnerable communities, such as the LGBTQ+ community and initiatives combating racism and anti-Semitism. How do you see this intersection of cybersecurity and social justice in terms of protecting these marginalized groups from digital threats?
An excellent question. And I was literally just at a breakfast where State Senator Michelle Hinchey was addressing this, right, with a new tech and AI committee that she announced. One of the things about this is, again, find out what's out there on you. And we have a lot of clients in these groups, all right? And we do special threat monitoring, and we leverage Roberto's background, who has developed some proprietary tools. We use several threat intel systems, one used by NATO. We have a lot of anonymous power to understand what the active threats are, what is actively being trafficked, and then make sure that what needs protecting is not out there, even if it means creating a new persona, right? So the greatest thing about security is misinformation is what you leave out there and dead ends, and the real stuff you keep to yourself. There's an old adage, how many people can keep a secret? How many people can you tell and have the secret kept? And the answer is one,
yeah.
Right? And it's a very important time for people to be protecting themselves when they are at risk. Also high-risk behaviors, okay? High-risk behaviors are gaming, dating sites, pornography, cryptocurrency, and ancestry sites, and I'm going to add a sixth now because it's so it's such a time of it, is activism. All right? And honestly, except for ancestry sites, which I would just unilaterally tell you to get off of, but make sure that you change the data to misinformation before you delete the account, which I can help people do, is there's a way to be safe in all of those other activities. And that's what we specialize in. We're not trying to have you have cumbersome systems where you get sick of it and, you know, like a New Year's resolution diet, which I literally broke 20 minutes ago, right, where you obviate the system because it's too ridiculous. We take your life and we show you how to be safe in that life.
You know, from that list that you just mentioned, I guess one of the things that surprised me the most was the ancestry site. They're presented as these almost harmless ways to learn more about your heritage. Oh, I'm 70% Sicilian versus 3% that I thought. But is it because they go so deep into your history that they make you that much more vulnerable?
Absolutely. Hackers love all the high-risk targets because they get everything. Okay? And I'm not talking about, you know, some deranged criminal sitting in a bathrobe in a basement. I am talking about organized crime rooms full of supercomputers that can take, 40 data points on you, run it through algorithms, and go steal your money, okay? Ancestry sites, Ancestry 23andMe, which is a real shame, was badly hacked, okay? They won a class action suit against them saying everybody's PII, they didn't protect it enough, and it was the people's fault, all right? They were important to people. They were medical, all right? People who were adopted went to look to see if there was any sort of systemic diseases or things they should be aware of, all right? Now, who hacked it? Was it criminals? Was it someone who wanted to sell a database to Merck or Pfizer to make better drugs? The point is it could be either. But you are not only compromising yourself and all your personal data on ancestry sites, you're literally compromising everyone in your bloodline. Mm-hmm. Because you're building those trees, right? Remember, security is keeping the family jewels to yourself. And unfortunately, and actually, you know what's really interesting? Is the safest people on these ancestry sites are the LGBT community because they have taught us something very important, and I urge everyone to do this. When it comes to what's my gender, I don't want to say, I'm fluid, I'm whatever. All those other choices make it so much harder to pinpoint who you are.
Oh, wow.
So I urge everybody to take a page from their book.
Wow.
Tell people what gender you are.
In the description for this workshop and this talk series at the Rosendale Theater on Wednesday, January 22nd, it says, you need new life skills. It's the dawn of 2025. If you don't understand the modern criminal and therefore victim behavior, you will become the latter. It's just a matter of time. Is that one of the most impactful things you've discovered during this process? I mean, I'm sure you've discovered many more things, but is it just that idea of like you need new life skills?
Yes, absolutely. You need new life skills. Okay. Yeah. Let's say you have lived in the country all your life and you moved to New York City. Boom, culture shock. This is culture shock. And I think AI is culture shock. Okay. But just take a deep breath. You are smarter than AI. All right. When you move to the big city, you all of a sudden acquire life skills. And this is just acquiring new life skills. And seriously, when you learn it at the core principle, it's like educators get this immediately, right? You know, when you're in preschool and elementary school, where you're learning foundational skills of critical thinking, research, self-awareness, things like that. When you learn this principle of criminal and victim behavior, you'll just apply it. You'll have your own answers about what to do.
It's a fascinating and necessary thing for folks to know. It's called Cybercrime Defense Life Skills We All Need to Know, part of the Today I Learned talk series at the Rosendale Theater in Rosendale, New York. It's coming up Wednesday, January 22nd. There is more information at rosendaletheater.org. And it's with the co-founders of Zero Hack, Roberto Gottardello and Rivka Tadger. And Rivka, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly. I forgot to ask you.
You are.
Okay, good. And you guys have extensive experience with this. And while it may sound frightening, folks can learn from you guys and you can become impervious to this constant barrage of breaches. Rivka, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And stay cyber safe out there. And anyone who has any questions, feel free to give me a call.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, the next steps in the schools merger, that's the Livingston Manor and Roscoe Central Schools, they're merging, and that school board election's coming up in less than a month. We'll have a report on what's next after this. This is Radio Chatsco.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, a newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Nearly 50 residents attended a meeting on Thursday last week to hear about the Roscoe and Livingston Manor school merger. Superintendent John Evans addressed their concerns and answered questions about the newly formed school district. The district is facing several important decisions very soon that will be made by the future school board. Radio Catskill's Jason Dole was at the meeting and has this report on the next steps.
Livingston Manor and Roscoe are two small hamlets in the town of Rockland, the northernmost township in Sullivan County. They're just 6 miles apart. But the two communities got even closer on December 19th when, after decades of discussion, residents in Roscoe and Livingston Manor finally voted to fully merge their two school districts.
As of the 19th, we are one school district. The two schools continue to operate till June 30th, but for all intents and purposes, all of the actions of this new board of education are for the newly created school district.
That's John Evans, superintendent of the now unified Livingston Manor Roscoe School District, addressing residents this past Thursday evening, January 9th. They met in the old auditorium at Livingston Manor Central School. Robert DeFore, district superintendent and CEO of Sullivan County BOCES, was also there to facilitate. In all, about 5 dozen folks were in attendance. Although this was the first public meeting since the merger vote, the purpose of Thursday's meeting was not to pick a name for the new school or a color or a mascot for its sports teams. It wasn't even about the district's staffing or how its existing facilities are now going to be used. Those decisions and many others need to be made by the new district school board, and it doesn't exist yet. So Thursday's meeting was all about getting that board in place as soon as possible, following a process from the New York Department of Education. So Thursday's meeting was all about getting that board in place as soon as possible, following a process from New York's Department of Education. Prospective board members were able to get petition forms at the meeting. They have 2 weeks to fill out and return the forms, complete with 25 signatures. Then, on February 13th, residents will vote for their new school's 7-member school board. That entire process from last Thursday's meeting to that school board election is just 5 weeks long. A lot of time at the meeting was spent just explaining all of these details and deadlines and fielding questions from the public about the whole process.
Who determined these dates for the election and can they push back?
The State Education Department set those dates.
Once the vote occurs to merge a district, the state education's charge is to establish that new board as soon as legally possible.
The new board doesn't have any authority to the school district merger. That would be
before. No, they do. This board, and that's where a merger is different than a normal board election. So these 7 individuals being elected on the 13th are being sworn in on the 18th and begin the work of the new school district. So their terms...
It's a non-existent school district, yeah, so I think...
It exists in the eyes of the state.
It is already in existence. At the time that the consolidation vote is approved, the district came into existence. This is the first step, electing a school board to govern a new district.
As you heard there, Evans and DeFore answered a question about the expedited timeline of selecting a new board, but they also had to go back and explain details about the district's current status. And that's not surprising. The district is in a state of transition that will last for most of the coming year, and that's confusing. For instance, although the new district exists as of December's vote, the two current school districts...
This is a randomized weekly test of WJFF's emergency alert system. This is only a test.
The new board will also meet. So if there's individuals on the current board, on the new board, they're going to have a very busy couple of months.
And this is something that we sat down with the attorneys with yesterday. So Roscoe and Manor, those existing board members, their terms actually go until August 1st. They don't end at June 30th like a normal board term would end. They go until August 1st because as Roscoe and Manor cease to exist on June 30th, there's still bills that have to be paid and things that have to be done as those respective school districts. And those boards will still continue to meet from now until June, doing what they normally would do, except they're not going to be building budgets. So theoretically, the existing board meetings should become shorter and quicker because the actions of the board are going to be streamlined because they're only doing the day-to-day business of the school, like approving warrants and things like that. They're not hiring people and things like that. Those would be things that the new board will be doing. So those meetings should get shorter. Some of them that were scheduled just for budget workshops and budget hearings are going to be eliminated because they're not necessary because the existing boards aren't building a budget. The new board is building a budget for the new district. So there's going to be less meetings of the existing boards, but more meetings of the new board.
So folks living in Livingston Manor and Roscoe are going to have three school boards from February through August. But in the middle of all that is the July 1st deadline. Evans explained that so many decisions have to be made by then because that's when the current school districts officially cease to exist.
This is why this board begins action now and has the legal authority because, for example, with school vehicles, Roscoe and Manor ceased to exist on June 30th. All of those vehicles, their registration and titles are no longer valid because those school districts don't exist. They have to be re-registered at the DMV under the new school name. So that name piece, by default, is Livingston Manor hyphenated Roscoe. If it's going to be something else, that's the first decision that the new board has to make because everything that gets set up at the state education department hinges on the school name.
There's a whole registration process of names with the state education department to issue identification numbers, access to financial information, calculations of ratios. Without a name, they can't do any of that.
With so much to decide in so little time, Evans made it clear that any prospective member of the new board will be very busy.
I have recommendations for the new board. Whether they follow those recommendations or decide to do something different, that is entirely up to them. I have no authority to tell them what to do. Those are board decisions. But in my conversations, I'm going to be recommending that the new board meet at least twice a month because the number of things that have to be decided on at a very rapid rate, if we only meet four times between now and July, July is going to be a mess.
Some in the audience seem to be very concerned about who may or may not wind up on the new Livingston Manor Roscoe School Board, how they make their decisions, and whether those decisions will reflect the wishes of community members. To that end, Superintendent Evans said he's recommending the new board create committees designed to get community input.
I've spent the last couple weeks meeting with superintendents from around the state that have gone through the merger process. There's not a lot of them because the last one that occurred was 6 years ago and the one before that was 12, and then you get to 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But in speaking with them, I've taken what they've learned through that process and put together a structure that I am going to go with the new board with on what I think will involve the most community input, put in the most checks and balances and accountability measures that we have been hearing about throughout this process, so that as the new school district gets created, people feel involved and people feel heard.
The next step in the process to select a school board for the new Livingston-Manorosco School District comes January 23rd, when prospective members' petitions are due in and the full ballot will be drawn up. The school board election is February 13th. For Radio Catskill, I'm Jason Dole.
And we'll take a break, and when we come back, celebrating the fusion of literature and art with a special event called Cover Story in Berryville. We'll tell you more with writer Busy Coy. This is Radio Chatsco.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA, the premiere of our new series, Hombre, Understanding Latino Men. Our first guest is political strategist Chuck Rocha.
There's a lot of Latino men who just don't participate in the process, who feel so left behind, and they work their butts off just trying to give out. Voting is the last thing on their mind.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Busy Coy is a writer. She primarily writes short fiction and short humor. Her work has been seen in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, Vulture, and other outlets. She's received fellowships from Fulbright, Niska, and McDowell, and she works as a freelance copywriter here in Sullivan County, New York. Her new humor book is called Personal Space. Chester's Creative in Berryville, New York, is hosting a special event with Busy called Cover Story, celebrating Personal Space, the book, and celebrating the fusion of literature and art. That's Sunday. In addition to Busy reading from the book, attendees will experience live art from the book's cover artist, Catherine Chesters, and the illustrator, Leah Strasser. And joining us in studio is Busy Coy, writer.
Hi,
how are you?
Oh, I'm fantastic.
Tell us, I would ask you about this event, but tell us a little bit about the book. For those who haven't read Personal Space yet, how do you describe the tone and approach to the subject of Personal Space?
Sure. Personal Space is my first book, so it's very exciting for me. It's a compilation of 20 short humorous pieces that have been previously published in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and other publications. I consider it a whimsical and occasionally absurd look at modern life. I find it resonates a lot with women. There are stories about being single and dating and motherhood, and things that are totally far afield, like traveling through space in search of a chicken wing. So it runs the gamut, but it really is just a good old-fashioned fun time.
I think modern life is absurd and whimsical, so that's a good thing. But is there a particular moment or experience that inspired this concept for Personal Space?
Sure. Well, actually, what inspired it is really living here in Sullivan County. You know, I did not become a writer in earnest and did not really pursue it seriously until I moved to Sullivan County in 2013.
Why is that?
You know, I was busy working and living life and doing other things. But when I moved here, all of a sudden, I was like, this place, it's beautiful. There's room to breathe. There's a slower pace of life. And I started writing, and a lot of my pieces were funny pieces, such as the ones that ended up in this book. And I've been writing and publishing these since, these short pieces since 2016. And I thought, you know, it's about darn time that I compiled some of my favorites, which are all over the internet. And, you know, they're all in these disparate places. And I wanted to have them all in one place for readers.
What was the process then for you writing this first book and a humor book at that?
So because I've been writing and publishing these pieces over about 9 years now, it's been a slow, slow process. The book didn't even come into my mind until I had already published maybe a couple dozen of these short humor pieces, and I wanted to put them all in one place.
And so you have an event with Chester's Creative called Cover Story on January 19th. And we're talking about celebrating art and literature. Tell us a little bit more about the event and what people can expect on Sunday.
Yeah. So when I started putting the book together, I didn't want it to be just about me. I felt like it was a community project. And as such, I recruited the artist Catherine Chesters locally to design the cover and provide the artwork. And also local illustrator Leah Strasser, who created some original artwork illustrations on the inside. And so the three of us thought it would be great to come together and sort of celebrate this fusion of writing and art with this event, which is kind of a twist on a traditional book reading. I will be reading a few pieces, but as I'm reading, Catherine Chesters and Leah Strasser will be creating art, kind of going back and forth, improvising on the wall, inspired by what I'm saying and also by what each other are creating on the wall as well.
So they're improvising art.
Yes, it's going to be very cool. And in addition to that, another celebration of the artwork is the painting and collage that is the basis of the cover is an original piece of Catherine's, and we're going to auction off that original piece.
Can you describe the cover? We can see it here, but for listeners.
Yeah, the cover, it's this whimsical image. It's part painting, part collage. Imagine a sort of robin's egg blue oval shape, like some kind of a strange creature, and it's got two legs akimbo sticking out of it, and there's a blue puddle, or maybe it's a cloud that the character is standing on. And it just, when I first saw it, I said, this just represents the whimsical, absurd nature of the book.
I'm getting a little Marlo Thomas, That Girl abstract going on there.
Yeah.
You know that series from the 60s?
Yeah.
Marlo Thomas?
You know,
the kind of like little cartoon figure, but just
absolutely.
The legs, like trapped in a blue egg.
Exactly. It's exactly the Marlo Thomas legs.
And I hope she's happy with them. How did you collaborate with them, or how involved were you in the artistic process with these illustrations and art with Catherine and Leah?
Well, they would probably say I was a little pushy.
Find out Sunday, corner them and ask.
Find out Sunday their real feelings about their collaboration with me. You know, with Leah, I told her the specific pieces in the book that I was thinking of getting illustrations for, and she just created these black and white line drawings that really just went beyond what I could have imagined when I told her to, you know, will you create some illustrations? And then with Catherine's cover, I mean, I also could not have envisioned the artwork that she provided. It's amazing. There's a magical thing where, as a writer, in my head, I go, I think I know what the cover looks like. But when you talk to an artist and you see their vision of it, it just explodes, you know, sort of your own expectations.
So it helps you convey the themes of the book anyway that are already in your head or on paper.
Even better than I could have on my own. Hence, community collaboration.
What do you think has influenced your sense of humor in your writing and throughout your writing career?
That's a great question. You know, growing up, my brother and I laugh. He's also a very funny writer, and artist himself. And we laugh about how we used to come home after school and watch TV we weren't allowed to watch, such as Saturday Night Live and, comedy shows that we weren't supposed to watch. And we just thought it was so funny. And I think that really triggered something in both of us to just like try to make each other laugh. And that I've carried that through my whole life.
Personal Space, the first book. What's next after this? Are you looking to write more books, or what are you looking to, what are you excited about?
You know, I'm always working on kind of different forms, and I think it's good for my mind to go from one form to another. I'm actually working on a play right now. That's sort of my next thing. Talk about community collaboration. You can't put on a play by yourself. Well, you could, but I don't think anyone would come see me doing a one-woman show. Yeah. So yeah, right now I'm working on a play, and we'll see how that goes. And then who knows what else?
How are you finding that experience? Is that daunting?
You know, my background is actually in theater. I went to college for theater, and I did a lot of performing as a teenager and young adult. So I'm finding it like a nostalgic visit home.
Is there, besides writing and outside of that creative process, and you mentioned living up here, are there other things that you've experienced that help influence you in some of the thoughts and whimsy?
Absolutely. Honestly, being in a community with so many visual artists was a real shift for me. Getting to know artists through DVAA, where I worked for a couple of years when I first moved up here, I was exposed to so much visual art. And as a writer, you know, it just pushes you outside of your comfort zone to see what other people are making. It also inspired me to take my work more seriously, to see the practice that these artists have and their commitment to it and their passion for it. I said, hey, like that, I can learn something from them.
It opened you up a bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The book is called Personal Space by Busy Coy. There is going to be a reading and the live drawing, live art at Chester's Creative. That's Sunday, the 19th from 2 to 4 at Chester's Creative in Berryville. There's more information at chesterscreative.com. And there's more information about you and your book at busycoy.com.
That's correct.
Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear from musicians Danielle Miraglia and Ariel Zivon. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
On the next Jazz Night in America, live music went dark with the pandemic. A young pianist found light with his innovative live streams. Pianist Emmett Cohen revives a century-old Harlem tradition, the rent party, with Emmett's Place. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Ariel Zivon, the daughter of renowned musician Warren Zivon, is making her return to the stage at Colony Woodstock in Woodstock, New York on Sunday with a co-bill performance. Boston area singer-songwriter Danielle Miraglia is joining her for an evening of music that blends folk, blues, and Americana influences. And both artists are joining us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Both of you have strong ties to the Vermont music scene. Ariel, we've spoken to you about that a little bit in the past, but I wanted to ask, you know, how's the local community shaped your music career, and what do you enjoy most about performing there?
Oh, I mean, you know, Vermont, it's not unlike, I don't think, Woodstock, New York, where it's like this real tight-knit, small community, artists, you know, throughout the state, you kind of cross paths a lot. It's super supportive. Just like Vermont is known to be, I think, on the whole, a lot of, you know, just real organic grassroots efforts to support arts and music and get together and, you know, all of that.
Danielle, do you experience the same there?
Yeah, a lot of my friends have migrated there. A lot of my music friends live in Vermont now. So, and people, friends of mine from the music scene and other musicians are now Vermonters. And I can confirm that it's a really nice scene up there.
Yeah.
Kind of happy place.
Yeah. Danielle, you've been described as an Americana blues practitioner with a distinctive sound. Tell us a little bit about how you first got into music and what led you into these genres.
Well, I mean, I always loved music from the minute I could remember. And I kind of grew up on the pop of the time, the 80s R&B, and then got into classic. First got into, you know, the heavy metal of the time and started playing guitar. And that kind of led to classic rock, which led to blues. So it's like kind of just digging deeper and deeper on what influenced what, you know? So that's what kind of brought me here. That's a really quick version of that.
Yeah. In a snapshot.
Into this. Where did Janis Joplin come from? Oh, blues. Okay. Let's go check that out.
I'll do that. Yeah. And Ariel, we've spoken to you before. Last year, we talked to you about your father's legacy in the music world and how you've carved out your own path in music. Talk a little bit about what you've been working on since we spoke to you last. I know that we talked about the Detangler, your album, and the personal nature of that. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm not recording currently. I've just been, I actually dove back into my original instrument, which was classical flute. So I've been sort of obsessively playing my flute more than anything in the most recent months. But and then what's cool about that is then I love blending that into
songs. So I've been like trying to find ways to blend all those, the diverse music influences that I have from classical to the heavier stuff, more. And, so yeah, I've been, you know, and I'm getting ready to come to New York. So I've been meeting up with my really great, friend and music collaborator, Dove Schiller, who's going to be with me playing percussion, drums. He's even going to bring his vibraphone this time, which is going to be really cool. Yeah, and doing some gigs up here in Vermont here and there, and living on my little hill in the woods.
How did the collaboration with Danielle come about for this performance at Colony Woodstock on Sunday?
Well, that was our friend Gary who booked this, put us together, and I just have to say here right now on the air, I'm so thrilled. I'm so excited to meet Danielle in person and get to hear her play. I've been listening to your music, you know, since I found out we were going to share the stage, and you know, fantastic. I am humbled by your ability to play that guitar.
Oh, wow. So you guys haven't performed together before?
No.
We haven't.
Our first
meeting. I'm equally as excited and thrilled for it. And now that I have just heard you talk about playing the flute, I might drag you into sitting in on a couple of
times. There's going to be a flute jam, everybody. Alert, alert. Let me ask you this then. Having not met, but like admiring each other's work, what's that like then getting together on stage for the first time? Are you guys experiencing, I mean, how does that kind of, not being a musician myself, do you just kind of fall right into it?
I think we already know each other because we're musicians and we're in the world together that way. So it's like meeting a family member or something when you've known each other's, when you listen to each other's work ahead of time. And then I don't know, it's part of what I love about playing out and, you know, is collaborating and just sharing bills with other like-minded people. You know,
I was going to ask this question of each of you, but I might ask this question for each of you about the other. So Danielle, your music and Ariel, both of your music, this seems to reflect very personal journeys and these deep connections with your own experiences. Danielle, do you see that or hear that when you listen to Ariel's music?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you take away from it?
it's very real and raw, and that's the bottom line, the honesty. You know, I think that always inspires me when I listen to someone else who is just telling it like it is. It's like, opens something out in you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And Ariel, does Danielle's music, does her musicality and her lyrics, do they resonate with you, and how do they resonate?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could just say ditto to what Danielle just said.
But, I'm gonna need a little bit more.
Said, for me, I you know, at first, because I tend to not consider myself a great guitarist, for example, and so like that was my initial like listening and watching some videos of her play, was like, oh, my jaw just dropped. So cool. And then the voice and the lyrics, the words that are, you know, I think there's an even extra layer of kinship probably for us female solo artists out there that are speaking our truths and sort of laying your heart out on the stage. You know, it's
Danielle, speaking of one woman show, or you got kind of a one woman band live sound, just an acoustic guitar sometimes and stomp box rhythms. How did you develop that sound, and what drew you to creating such a minimalist but powerful live experience?
Well, before I played with the band, it was really about how can I make the most of what I can do, you know, solo. It's more economical. You know, it's tough to travel with a band, you know, so it was like, it kind of just developed over time. I started out just like stomping on the stage when I was playing, at some point I realized I liked sitting better than standing. There was something, especially when I was doing, you know, I used to do these like long bar gigs where I'd be stuffed in a corner, you know, and just, you know, looking at some back, looking at baseball caps and people's backs and look while they're looking at the game, you know? And, so I decided, it just felt like more dignified to sit and play for some reason in a situation like that. It's like, hey, if you want to listen to me, you can, or you don't have to. And that's when I started stomping. And then it was like, oh, maybe I can mic this up. Let's see what happens. You know, it just kind of slowly developed into that.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that we got to talk to the two of you together here, and happy that we were able to introduce you first via radio, and then you'll meet each other in person on Sunday at Colony Woodstock to play. I think it's really cool when these musicians who haven't really met but admire each other are able to get together and just like have a great singing concert, you know, bang it out, I guess, right? Colony Woodstock, it's Ariel Zevon and Danielle Miraglia that they're performing at Colony Woodstock on Sunday at 7. There's more information at colonywoodstock.com. Danielle and Ariel, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to leave folks with a little bit of Danielle's song, Monster, from the All My Heroes Are Ghosts album? Is that right, yep. Danielle?
That's it.
All right. You guys have a great show, and we'll have to follow up and see how it went after you've met each other, okay?
All right.
Great.
See Sunday, Ariel.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, all right. Here's Monster.
Take some beats and drop them in. Build your track.
Danielle Miraglia of Monster, and she is performing with Ariel Zevon on Sunday at Colony Woodstock. And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, we want to remind you that we have reaction to Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State on our website. We heard from State Senator Peter Oberrocker from New York's 51st District in our listening area. Also, Assembly Member Paula Kay from New York's 100th District here. And we have some analysis from the New York Public Network's Ian Pickus, the news director of WAMC. You can find all of that and more at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
This is Jeff Loeffler. Join me each and every Friday, 10 to midnight, as we go deep, playing songs that you don't hear on the radio all the time. It's the Deep End.
Deep End.
Deep
End.
Deep cuts and live tracks from the worlds of classics, psych, prog, jam, and blues rock. The Deep End, each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, breezy with some snow showers at times, high 21. Tonight, breezy, still flurries this evening, a low of 13. A little afternoon snow tomorrow, high of 22. Tomorrow night, it's low 17. And looking ahead, not as cold for Friday, high of 33. Saturday and Sunday look to be around 30 with a chance of afternoon snow on both days. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.